You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the American Postal Workers Union, Local 67, and Blake and Ulig. American Postal Workers, Local 67, serving the greater Kansas City area and providing protection of labor rights for our members on both sides of the state line, as well as all our labor brothers and sisters across America. We will continue to fight to stop the closings of processing plants and post offices around the country, to protect universal service for all our customers, and push back against the corporate forces that would dismantle this sacred public institution. And Blake and Ulig, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, cities around the country are befuddled by what to do with a flood of electronic scooters in the streets. Have you seen them? Are they safe? Do they create good jobs? Then, there's been a proliferation of pro-labor leftist podcasts changing the media landscape. Will the revolution be podcasted? Find out on tonight's show. In the news, Michigan outlaws the tipped minimum wage and Nike to the rescue? Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. Her headlines are: are more construction workers dying from opioids than from job site hazards? And rail car cleaning company accused of multiple unsafe practices and lying? And court tells Environmental Protection Agency that it can't ignore science. What a shock. Now for the news.
September 6, 2018. The Michigan House of Representatives and Senate on Wednesday passed a one fair wage bill, bringing the number of states that have abolished their tipped minimum wage to 8. Besides Michigan, there are Nevada, California, Alaska, Montana, Minnesota, Washington, and Oregon. Also, the cities of Washington, D.C., and Flagstaff, Arizona, required all tipped employees to be paid at least the same minimum wage as other workers. The Michigan legislature, faced with a ballot initiative with over 400,000 signatures, simply adopted its language. Voters in Washington, D.C. and Flagstaff, Arizona, passed similar citizen-led initiatives, gradually increasing the wage for tipped workers to the full minimum wage. The effort was led by the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United and its One Fair Wage campaign. a project that educates about and advocates for raising the sub-minimum tipped wage to the full minimum wage across 43 states, some of which, like Kansas, still pay tipped workers at an unimaginable $2.13 per hour. 66% of tipped workers are women, many of them are women of color and immigrants. While declaring victory, Michigan One Fair Wage campaign manager Pete Vargas said, "We are well aware of the House leadership's intent in adopting this measure. They hope to suppress voter turnout amongst workers, people of color, and immigrants by keeping the measure off the ballot, then gut legislation during the same duck season." He pledged to fight for high voter turnout in November and promised to sue the legislature if it repeals the measure after an initiative is dropped. The new law will raise the Michigan minimum wage to $12 an hour for all workers. Over 1 million workers and their families will benefit.
Speaking of the minimum wage, Missouri has its own initiative called Raise Up Missouri, which, if it passes, would raise the state's minimum to $12 by 2023. It would leave the tip minimum at 50%. The campaign has qualified for the November ballot, where it will appear as Proposition B. It got a big boost this week from dark money. That's right, progressives are using dark money too. The campaign got $3 million from the 1630 Fund, a nonprofit based in Washington, D.C. The fund had previously donated $1 million for the signature gathering phase of the Raise Up efforts. Part of the motivation for this large donation, speculates the Kansas City Star, is to increase voter turnout in November and help in the re-election campaign of Claire McCaskill.
This book, Being About Work, is by its very nature about violence, to the spirit as well as to the body. It is about ulcers as well as accidents, about shouting matches as well as fist fights. It is, above all, about daily humiliations. To survive the day is triumph enough for the walking wounded among the great many of us. So begins Studs Terkel's celebrated book, Working, a compendium of one-on-one interviews with working men and women from all walks of life to create one of the finest examples of nonfiction writing ever created. Next Monday evening, Earth, that's Equity Actors Readers Theater, in partnership with the Kansas City Public Library, will present a free one-night-only concert-style stage reading of selections from Studs Terkel's Working. This free reading will be presented at 6:30 p.m. at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Library. The branch is located at 4801 Main Street, just south of the plaza. The nine performers are all members or past members of Actors Equity Association, the union of professional actor and stage managers in the United States. Come help Earth and the Library belatedly celebrate Labor Day. Of course, Labor Day was last week, but that's okay. And the labor movement in the United States. Come celebrate the working men and women who keep this country moving forward.
Some are calling it a stroke of genius. Others are selling their stock. That's the reaction to Nike's decision to make football's most controversial player, Colin Kaepernick, to lead the company's 30th anniversary Just Do It campaign. Kaepernick is the blacklisted San Francisco 49ers quarterback who had the audacity to kneel during the national anthem in protest of cop killings of black people. His grievance against being dropped is waiting to go on to arbitration, but he may have found another job for Nike. The Nike ad says, "Believe in something even if it means sacrificing everything. Just do it." It truly warms the heart to see a big corporation like Nike rescuing a worker like Colin and standing up for his right to free speech. But of course, it appears some of Nike's own workers could stand to be rescued too. Just yesterday, a footwear publication, Soul Collector, reported, less than a month after being hit with a lawsuit from former employees over gender discrimination allegations, Nike is once again getting sued for its so-called boys club culture. Three unnamed Nike investors filed suit against the brand Friday in Oregon. In the suit, the shareholders argue that the swoosh has harbored a hostile work environment that is now harmed and threatens to further tarnish and impair Nike's financial position, as well as its reputation and goodwill. The suit is said to specifically target Nike co-founder Phil Knight, CEO Mark Parker, and ousted brand president Trevor Edwards. A lawyer who filed the case said, "Stockholders are concerned that the board has allowed rampant sexual harassment and gender discrimination to go on within the company unfettered for as many as 20 years. Then, of course, there's the thousands of dollar-a-day women in Indonesia and Vietnam who toil in Nike's subcontracted workshops, sweatshops, making the shoes, who are also waiting for rescue, just like Colin Kaepernick. The news tonight was read by Christina Dismang, Greg Swartz, Judy Ansel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
If she won't bang, you let her bang. He said he bleeding with a stain. The top of food chains, they local, I don't even know the name. I've been fresh since a kid, ain't never played. I just picked up a back in Rotterdam. I'ma whip out the back and pop your brain. I do what I want and shout it can't. I do what I feel and shout it can't. I'm digging, I digging, shout it lame. And all of them say they dig that. From Maine way to Spain, all I got is some chicken for the thots. I take on like a plane, I'm gonna be. Like a rocket man, yeah, like a rocket man, yeah. I'm a rocket man. On a private honor, I'm a rocket launcher. It gotta be the pride of something. I bought that man stumbling. I stumble up on a mill. I stumble up on a 1,000,005. I spent a fortune on them double seals. If I tell you the numbers, you probably cry. If I tell you you're faking, you probably die. These days, if he say that he hit, then he probably lie. If you say you got wings and some fish, then you probably fry. Got my carrots out of Bunny Clyde. She let me back in like she never cried. She let me back in like I never lied. I look like a cat with 11 lives. I really, you can ask a fly. I'm steady chasing like I'm never tired. I'm living scary like 100 highs. La mama says he ain't butterflies. Yeah. I'm a rocket man.
That was a beautiful rendition of Elton John's Rocket Man by Young Thug. Hello, everyone. This is Jacob White. You're listening to Heartland Labor Forum. I hope you had a good Labor Day. This week, in honor of going back to school, we are going to be talking about a kid's toy that is suddenly all the rage among grown-ups. Electronic scooters have been hard to miss if you live in Kansas City, or in many other cities across the country. You might find them neatly lined up, ever so conveniently, on the sidewalk outside your favorite restaurant or ice cream shop. On the other hand, you might find them laid out on the grass in Gillam Park, soaking in the sun but not charging. No, these scooters are not solar-powered, but they are dockless, so I've seen them laid out pretty much everywhere about town. I've also seen them in motion. I've seen them in motion on the sidewalk and in the bike lane, on the street. I've seen them worn with helmets. I've seen them mostly worn without helmets. Anyways, I don't think I'm the only person befuddled by these newfound contraptions. It seems that people in charge of keeping pedestrians and streets safe are having a hard time figuring out e-scooters as well. So today we'll talk about it. First off, we will listen to a report from KCTV5 about the scooter ban on the plaza, since lifted. And then we will chat with Heather Burke, a spokesperson from Denver Public Works of City and County of Denver in Colorado, about how Denver is adapting to these new mobility devices. Once again, thanks for listening to Heartland Labor Forum. I hope you enjoy tonight's show.
You may have seen these bird scooters around town, even around the plaza for a bit. But now the message is clear. The pedestrian-friendly area says many were taking the bird for a spin on sidewalks. And a spokesperson with the plaza said in part, after safety incidents resulted in numerous customer and tenant complaints, Bird is pausing its operations until we can assess whether scooters are the right addition to our pedestrian-heavy district.
I think that's terrible. I think they're a great way to get around. They looked really cool and like a really neat idea, so I think that's unfortunate.
But many we spoke with say they get it.
I think it's ridiculous. I think that people should walk. There's no reason to be on an electric scooter.
It should be a pedestrian area only.
I get it. I mean, it's like sidewalks everywhere and it's pretty narrow.
We contacted the company, and a Bird spokesperson said in a statement, "We are in communication with city officials regarding the plaza and are working together to ensure that Bird is operating in accordance with city guidelines."
And you can still ride around on a Bird in other areas of KC, just not the plaza. And the Bird app will let you know where you can properly pick up one.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jacob White. And joining me today is Heather Burke, and she's representing Denver Public Works for the City and County of Denver. Heather, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This summer, Kansas City has been struggling to adapt to the e-scooter phenomenon that's sort of taken over across the country. The city's prime shopping district, the Plaza, had banned them for a little while, but now it seems they're back. Denver has been in the spotlight in terms of cities that are trying to balance the excitement of new modes of transportation with the realities of maintenance needs and the toll on streets and sidewalks. Can you tell us where things stand in Denver now, and what are some of the key problems Public Works wants addressed when it comes to this new e-scooter and e-bike phenomenon?
Yeah, well, Denver developed an innovative permit program that we're piloting to quickly to react to illegal launches of electric scooters on our public right-of-way. However, we did it in a unique way that reflects our objectives for this new mobility option. Our goal and our approach to this pilot is to minimize negative impacts on the right-of-way, provide predictability to our traveling public, and provide our staff with an opportunity to assess the benefits of these services, including their ability to contribute towards the city's mobility and also our Vision Zero safety goals. So we want to see if these electric scooters and these dockless bikes can help meet the city's goals of enhancing the use of transit and bus service throughout the city, providing people with more choices to get around, and reducing those single occupancy vehicle trips. So right now in Denver, you know, this is a new mobility option, so there is still a learning curve, but we are communicating with the operators regularly about compliance issues because, you know, these are revocable permits, so we want to make sure that people are operating them or riders are using them appropriately.
Has the response that Public Works heard been fairly balanced? That's certainly how it's been presented in the news articles that I've read, that some people are really excited about it and then other people are more ambivalent about it, and especially with how they sort of seem to be strewn all over the place, which is a phenomenon I see in Kansas City too. I live across from a park and I just see them sort of like lying out on the park sometimes, and I'm worried maybe someone will trip over them or something. But how have you noticed the balance? And then if you want to address the the dockless nature also.
Right. So some folks are really excited about them. They think this is a really cool new mobility option to get around. And then there's other folks who aren't so crazy about them. As part of this permit program, we're asking riders to return these scooters and dockless bikes at a bus or transit stop, because again, it's all about that goal of helping enhance transit in our city. And the operators are also required to continuously rebalance these vehicles at bus and transit stops. And as far as riding, in Denver, our local law and state law classifies electric scooters as toy vehicles. So that means they're only allowed to ride on the sidewalk, so they can't ride in the street or in the bike lanes. However, Denver Public Works is currently trying to navigate through that local and state law to see if we can find ways to allow the electric scooters in the bike lanes, but we're not there yet. So, you know, for us right now, it's really all about that education. We ask riders to watch your speeds and yield to pedestrians at all times. And, you know, the operators are also required as part of their permit to make sure to educate their users on how to properly ride and park these new vehicles.
There's definitely a ton of stakeholders involved. It's kind of, it can be overwhelming at times. I think for our show, one of the groups that I'm pretty interested in, and I don't know if you've spoken a lot with them, is it seems like birds, the chargers, the people who are supposed to go and pick up the scooters at the end of the night and then strategically place them the next morning, it seems like they might have a lot of input to offer when it comes to making these sort of decisions. But they're also, I'm not really sure like what their employment thing is like with the companies themselves. So how has navigating that gone with, they have a pretty non-traditional workforce?
Well, we've been in constant communication with them. You know, we, as part of their permit, we are requiring them to rebalance these electric scooters and dockless bikes at bus and transit stops. So they've been pretty good at rebalancing them at bus and transit stops every morning, and we are working with them to continue that rebalancing throughout the day.
And they also, I think it was Denver. I've been reading about a few different cities, but a possible incentive program. Were you going to cap how many scooters there could be to start, and then have some incentives about some less privileged neighborhoods, or am I thinking of a different city?
Yeah, well, you know, as far as scooters, the cap is 350 scooters with 100 of their total fleet committed to places that we call opportunity areas. So, you know, those are areas where we're seeing a lot of folks taking the bus and they don't own a vehicle. So we're really trying to see if by placing scooters and dockless bikes at those opportunity areas, it could really help give those people, you know, the extra boost that they need to get to the bus or to get to the light rail. So that's something that is part of the permit, and we will look at and see if it could help reach those goals for those folks.
When you're talking with the with some of the other stakeholders, with the companies and people more on that side of the issue, do you get the sense that the premise was that it's supposed to, I think it's called like a last mile thing, like in Kansas City, a lot of the buses have bike racks so that if you ride your bike to the bus, then you can get on the bus and bring your bike with you. Is that how they've presented it too, or is it more of like a touristy thing, or maybe a balance?
You know, I think our goal is to just see if it could, you know, if this new mobility option can help us meet that goal of enhancing transit. Again, it's a new program. It just launched. Lime and Bird just launched scooters in, I believe, July or August. It was later this summer, so we still have to see how it's going to work and if it's helping us reach those goals.
You said the current cap is 350. How many were there initially? And it was unexpected for you guys, right?
So this is a new program. So when you mean before, I'm not sure what you mean.
Like, were there initially like 500 scooters and then the city was like, we're going to cap it at 350 or?
No, I mean, so before the companies launched their scooters without our knowledge. Uh-huh. So we quickly developed this innovative permit program to react to those illegal launches. So there was nothing in place before for a cap or anything like that. We didn't have a permit program in place for these types of vehicles.
There's a lot of consternation, not just about with the physical space that the scooters take up, but also with some of the data and how the data is going to get used. It seems like maybe these scooters might be beneficial as far as collecting data that Public Works might use and that the city might use to enhance transportation options. I think I saw in the plan that you guys wrote up that there is some of that involved. What sort of thinking has gone into that, and do you think that that is going to have some concrete benefits?
Absolutely. We have asked the operators to share user data with us, and I think for us that'll kind of help paint the picture of, you know, how many folks are using them, what kind of users are riding this type of mobility option, and it'll really help us as we look ahead to our future mobility goals for Denver.
We're talking with Heather Burke. She works at Denver Public Works for the city and county of Denver, and we're talking about how cities can respond to the e-scooter phenomenon, which, as we've mentioned a lot, is a really new phenomenon, and it's really only in these last couple months that it's been expanding. So I imagine there's a lot of cities that are really curious about your guys' pilot program. Have you gotten a lot of engagement with other cities? Is there some curiosity about how this is going to work out?
Sure, yeah. We've heard from, you know, cities all across the country who are interested in our approach as they, you know, try to find ways to manage these new mobility options in their cities. So, you know, we're very excited that we can share our experience and, you know, and our innovative program with other cities around the country.
All right. I think that's about all I've got for you today, Heather. Thanks so much for joining us, and we will keep following what's going on our streets in our big cities. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. Bye.
See ya.
Potluck Productions, an organization that produces scripts written by area women, will present its next Sunday play reading on September 9th at the Yoga Patch, 7235 Central. The show begins at 3 p.m. and will feature four short plays that focus on the absurdities of life and love. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Did you know that you can donate that unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling 866-628-2277.
Good evening, and you are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight, we're going to be talking about our podcast, part of our revolution. Tonight, we will be talking with Jacob Weick about the podcasts and about how they're going to be our future. Hello, Jacob.
Hi, how's it going, Christina? Can you hear me?
Well, first off, could you please tell us about, very first question is, could you please tell us about what are podcasts?
Sure. So a lot of people know about what since the beginning of the internet, it's been seen as an opportunity for people to put out their own media that's different than what you might hear you know, on commercial radio and stuff. So the idea of the podcast is actually not really that different from the idea of community radio, which is that there tends to be a lot of monoculture in U.S. radio stations. A lot of them are owned by the same small number of corporations. They play the same songs by Ariana Grande over and over again. Not that there's anything wrong with her, great musician, but so there tend, and even in the talk radio, we know that there's a lot of, you know, there's sort of a narrow window of what you can talk about, what you can say. So podcasts sort of emerge out of different communities and subcultures that don't necessarily hear their own voices in mainstream radio and mainstream media. Now, that some podcasts have gone into the mainstream, for sure. Some even, you know, for instance, Joe Rogan, he has a podcast, and he came and he did a show in Kansas City not long ago that had a really big attendance. And he goes all over the country and gets a lot of people, and millions of people listen to his podcast every week. So I'm not saying that they're all necessarily, you know, small and sort of niche, but a decent number of them are. And podcasts, basically, as long as you have a computer and a microphone and, you know, a way to record and to broadcast, you can say kind of whatever you want and post it, and people can reply and comment and give feedback like they would on other media sources also.
All right, and we know that podcasts have been around for a while. However, why do you think leftist podcasts are getting so popular now?
Well, for a couple of reasons, I think. There's no way to avoid the elephant in the room, or maybe not an elephant, but definitely a large thing, which is our 45th president. And since his election, there have been over 1,000 new political podcasts that have come out, and most of them tend to be, you know, part of the hashtag resistance to some degree or another. And I think that some of that is a response to the current political situation. We saw after the 2008 and 2012 elections, when Obama was elected, that political podcasts only went up by about 10% after each of those elections, whereas 1,000 new political podcasts represents a 35% increase. This is according to an article in Vice. So we're seeing a huge proliferation, in part just because of the political climate. Another reason is because I think of the success that we're seeing with some of these podcasts in particular. So if you look at Chapo Trap House is a very popular podcast with a lot of young people, people in Brooklyn, people in New York City, and people in Kansas City also. I mean, kind of all over the country. They have a following, but they have really gotten big, and they have over 2,000 people that listen and subscribe to their show every month. And they also just released a book that is the number 6 nonfiction bestseller on the New York Times list. So they really have a big following, and they have a lot of support, and there's sort of been a lot of piggybacking on what they've been doing and following what they've been doing since the election of President Trump.
Well, since with all these over 1,000 podcasts, new podcasts have turned out ever since the last election, what are some different formats these podcasts may take?
Sure. So some of them are kind of like what Heartland Labor Forum has been doing, which is we are on air like we are right now from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock on Thursday, and then from 5 o'clock to 6 a.m. on Friday. And then we also make a podcast. And I would really recommend that people listening right now, whether you have an iPhone or an Android, whatever podcatcher you use after the show is over, or even now if you're just looking at your phone, if you want to add Heartland Labor Forum, you can also listen to this show in podcast form. And I like to do that sometimes, too. If I can't listen to the show live, you know, you just go, and every time we post a new show the next morning, you can listen to us. So there's legacy media, I guess you could call it, where you're on a radio station and you make your own podcast and put it on after. There's also comedy. So Chapo Trap House is a comedy show. Tonight in Kansas City, The Street Fight Radio guys are in town, and they're also a podcast comedy show. Of course, there's dramatic shows and all sorts of different stuff, pretty much any form of recording, audio recording that you might hear on the radio. Someone has probably done a podcast about it also. So a lot of different forums, a lot of different formats. Some people do call-in shows, you know, which can go on for hours and hours. And I think in a lot of ways, this new phenomenon is sort of a response to the sort of Rush Limbaugh era of conservative sort of shock jock talk radio. If you listen to a lot of these new podcasts that have come out, a lot of them sort of take a similar thing where they're not really ashamed of being biased or of having a very specific political slant. And, you know, some of them also are not necessarily as regulated, so they might have some more hard language involved in them that they don't get in trouble for using, you know, words that we can't use here on Heartland Labor Forum. And they tend to take a very specific slant, and I think that that's sort of been a desert, aside from community radio stations like ours. There's a big dearth, and that's sort of emerged recently, and the podcast has been a medium that people can express themselves with their politics and their comedy and their art.
And just to back you up a little bit, you had mentioned that one of the podcasts, comedy podcasts, would be here in Kansas City, Street Fight. Could you describe them a little bit more, like what they're about, in case any of our listeners are interested?
Yeah, so I started listening to Street Fight when I was working at a toy store, and I was unpacking and packing boxes, and it kind of was tedious and not very fun. And the Street Fight guys, they were on WCRS in Columbus, Ohio, which is a very similar community radio station to what we have here with KKFI. And I just started listening to their podcast, and they talked about work. They worked in call centers. They worked as cable guys. They worked in delivery services. They just had a lot of regular jobs, and they would talk about them. And I kind of would feel like comforted and like, okay, so like this is, you know, this is the working world. This is sort of how things are. But they also brought a really funny spin to it. And so they are Brett and Brian, and they're from Columbus, and right now they're on a tour of the Midwest. And a big part of, I think they're really funny and great guys, and I would be happy for their success either way. A big part of their success, though, is that the guys from Chapo Trap House, which is the podcast that just had a best-selling nonfiction New York Times list book come out, their podcast emerged from, they all met while they were guests on Street Fight Radio. So these guys are sort of like the OG early version of this sort of irreverent leftist, pro-worker, pro-labor, honest about economic conditions in our country, and activist in terms of making the world a more progressive and better place. They sort of brought all that niche. They were sort of the originators in a lot of ways. And so I'm really excited to see that they're going on tour and that they've had increasing success. I'm excited that they're coming to Kansas City tonight. And I wish we could have gotten them on the show tonight, but as the New Yorker likes to say, artists have very busy and unpredictable lives, and you can never know when exactly they're going to do what. So, you know, the show was supposed to be last night, and now it's tonight, but this is the way things go, especially in the entertainment world. So I was happy to come in and talk about why podcasts are important for me. I mean, they are a big part of why I contribute to Heartland Labor Forum. And I think that they're a really great show. So they're in town tonight. If you want to look up their Facebook page, you could get some more information about that.
All right. So if anyone is interested, you can look them up on Facebook, Street Fight Radio. So just keep on moving this forward. Has there been any crossover from the subculture with podcasts into the mainstream?
Definitely. I think one podcast that a lot of our listeners and a lot of people that listen to KKFI might know about is Pod Save America, which is like a lot of guys who were in the Obama administration. And they have a lot of supporters. Well, they have a lot of listeners in high places. So, for instance, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Chris Murphy, a lot of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party in Congress right now has actually, you know, they download that podcast and they download some other podcasts as well. So I think that the influence, you know, no podcast right now is at the point where it's as influential as like Meet the Press or something like that, or some, you know, Firing Line or any of the, you know, big television cable shows, which are getting, you know, millions of viewers every night. I think that, like I said, Joe Rogan is like probably the most popular podcast right now. And I think he gets maybe like a million downloads, maybe more than that on every episode, but that's really rare. A lot of these podcasts are still sort of in the fledgling stage where maybe they get, you know, 400 to 1,000 to 10,000 listeners, but the people who are listening are really engaged and they really care a lot about whatever the topic at hand is. You know, some of them are like really specific. Some of them are academic. Some of them are about labor. Some of them are about politics. So in terms of crossover, yeah, you're seeing the main things being in politics. It would have to be Pod Save America, which is a very popular among the left wing of the Democratic Party, like I said. And then in culture, there's Joe Rogan, who talks about all sorts of stuff, and he does politics too, but he's not as partisan as some of the other shows. So it's still sort of in the middle. I think you could definitely say that if you look at how many people have downloaded, you know, podcast catchers of different varieties on their phones, that it's a big part of people's everyday lives, especially people that are in the, you know, millennial generation or below that. They're a lot of conversations revolve, oh, what podcast do you listen to, much in the same way that people talk about which shows they listen to. But at the same time, the fact that it's not just limited by the number of companies that own the media outlets and the number of media outlets themselves, there's just a big flowering of all sorts of different content that you can listen to on podcasts. So, you know, I think the medium, you could say, has gone mainstream, but there's still a lot of people who are making stuff that's sort of on the margins or outside of what you would hear on corporate media.
And with all these podcasts out there, I know it probably could be overwhelming for some of our listeners, but for the people who listen to the Heartland Labor Forum, what do you think, what podcasts would you recommend to them?
So I would start with the Heartland Labor Forum podcast, which I'm going to plug again, which I think that people should download that and listen to it. We put that out every week. And I would also really recommend any of the content that gets recorded and then saved and then put up on the website at KKFI. Outside of that, on the national scale, I really recommend the Street Fight guys. If you go to their show tonight and have some laughs, go ahead and sign up for their podcast and download that. Chapo Trap House is also really funny. More serious political podcasts. When we had our meeting, our radio show meeting, people recommended Black Agenda Radio, which is a really good news and analysis from the Black left. They interview a lot of people that, you know, we might hear that interview on that national show and then be like, you know, that would be a really great guest to have on Heartland Labor Forum. Another really good podcast is This Is Hell in Chicago by Chuck Mertz. They are 4 hours live every morning, or live on Saturday mornings from the Northwestern University radio station. The guests that they have on that show also can influence and inspire what guests we wind up having here on Heartland Labor Forum. Sojourner Truth Radio from KPFK in Pacifica Radio in LA. Same with them. They have roundtables. It's very political, very serious. They tend to talk about issues that maybe MSNBC doesn't talk about, or maybe they push issues hard, and then if they get pushed hard enough, they might get on MSNBC. And I think that that might be a big part of this, too. A lot of these shows, like This Is Hell or Black Agenda Report or Sojourner Truth, these shows that we listen to, that I listen to, podcasts to get inspiration for what we should do on Heartland Labor Forum, are also pretty critical of like what MSNBC might be doing right now. So if you are kind of tired of hearing about Russiagate, if you're tired of hearing about Russia all the time and you want to know more about what's going on with the environment, or you want to know what's going on with labor and workers' rights, these are better shows to listen to than what you might get on MSNBC. So specific labor shows, there's Belabored with Sarah Jaffe. That's a really good podcast. Jacobin Magazine has a podcast that's also very good. And The Real News Radio, where we also, they have on Dean Baker and a lot of other guests, Richard Wolf, that you might hear on KKFI, on Heartland Labor Forum. You can access them and download those podcasts also. So on a national scale, those are really good ones for people who are looking for more information about the economy, about NAFTA, about workers' rights, about the Supreme Court, and feel like when they are turning on CNN or MSNBC, they're hearing, you know, not that it's not interesting and not that there's not a lot of compelling storylines, but the only thing that, you know, Democrats and people to their left and, you know, people in the progressive movement in the United States, you know, we have to worry about more than Russia. We have to talk about issues that are impacting people on the ground every day. So these are really good alternative media sources to find that kind of information.
Hey, Jake, it's Jen.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, I just wanted to put in my hat in the ring here, too, and saying that, you know, podcasts for me in the Trump, in the, you know, the Trump era has, I mean, I never listened to podcasts until now. And it's, I think it's amazing. I think the I think the revolution definitely is being podcasted. And I've got two that I recommend that I listen to every week. And, you know, it's for people, they're political podcasts. One is pretty serious. The other one is pretty irreverent, but still have good points. You know, for people like me who are not big policy wonks, who aren't big, you know, like when we're reading news articles, there's a lot of jargon and a lot of things that are confusing, and especially things about law and national security. And Lawfare is a think tank. They're a blog that is from the Brookings Institution think tank, and they have a podcast weekly and sometimes an emergency podcast when big news drops. And they help kind of break down and unpack all the big news of the day and put it into layman's terms, especially when things that have to do with political law and national security that the average person might not understand. And the second one is called Rational Security, and that is basically Lawfare After Dark, and they do that every Wednesday. And it's an irreverent discussion, and it's really funny, but also another good way to unpack what is going on and how to, you know, how to reframe our thoughts about it as just the public. And I've found both of them to be highly educational. So, yep, I'm with you. I think podcasts are definitely what's happening right now.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, especially about, you know, so you read something in the newspaper and maybe you get a talking point or a sound clip from both sides, but there's not really, you're like, I want to know more about that, you know.
Right, the context.
The podcast is just a great forum to do that.
Absolutely agreed.
All right.
Yeah, and
oh, sorry, you can continue. Oh, no, I was just saying I absolutely agree that podcasts now, I'm listening more to them than I do with mainstream media. It's something that has been becoming more and more relevant. It's more of a niche where I can more listen to people's stories and not just mainstream media. And since
Christina.
Oh, no, go right ahead.
The one thing I think that might be nice for us to do is to hear back from some of our listeners about what podcasts they're listening to. So maybe when we post this clip on social media, when we put it on our Facebook page, if people want to comment under and talk about what they're listening to, I think that might also give us a really good ideas for what kind of shows we should be making also, if they have some guests that they hear. So, fan feedback, audience feedback, if anyone else wants to share from the Heartland Labor Forum community what podcasts they've been listening to, I think that, you know, that would really benefit us.
And to just round it off, for people who are just joining us, we've been talking about podcasts and how they have jump-started this new revolution of listening to radio. And Jake, can you tell us once again, to our listeners, how can you listen to the KKFI podcasts?
Yeah, so go to the KKFI.org, and then when you go to shows, you can click on each of the shows, and then there will be archived show. And if you go to the Heartland Labor Forum one, which I hope everyone's been doing, you can go and you'll see a short description of what that week's show is about, and then you can either stream it on your computer or you can download it and listen to it later. We try to get our shows up pretty fast, and it's always great when they get shared. I know recently I did a show about question one, and I got some people, there were quite a few people who shared it on social media or who shared it on their different web pages that had to do with question one. So podcasts, yeah. Broadcast radio is really great, and, you know, we're super thankful to be here on KKFI, and it's also really great, though, that we can record it and people can take it with them and listen to it later.
Absolutely.
And hopefully not edit it.
And
make it sound like we say things that we didn't, because we have the original copies. Don't edit anything I say, please.
Oh, absolutely. We will not. Don't worry about that. And and thank you so much for joining us tonight. And to our listeners, that was Jake White talking about the future of podcasts. And you are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Hello, this is Mary Ario for Safety First with a slight cold. First, are more construction workers dying from opioids than job site hazards? From the Laborers Health and Safety Fund September newsletter at www.lhsfna.org. It's been clear for a while that the opioid epidemic is having an alarming impact on construction workers. A major one is that year after year, construction continues to rank among the most dangerous occupations. Serious injuries are often treated with prescription painkillers, putting construction workers at risk for opioid dependence and even death. A new report from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health is showing just how deadly opioids have been for construction workers in the Bay State. The report examined fatal overdoses in the state by occupation between 2011 and 2015 and found that construction workers accounted for more than 24% of opioid-related deaths. Construction workers had the highest rate of opioid overdose of any profession and were 6 times more likely to die of an opioid overdose than the average Massachusetts worker. In all, 1,096 Massachusetts construction workers died of an overdose in the 5-year span. That is 16 times more than from all other causes of workplace deaths combined. The MDPH report lists several reasons why construction workers are at such high risk for opioid abuse and overdose compared to other workers, including higher risk of work-related injury, a lack of paid sick time and job insecurity, availability of opioid drugs on construction sites, and stigma surrounding addiction. Next, railcar company accused of multiple unsafe practices and lying. From www.ehstoday.com for August 31st. 3 years after two of its employees died and a third was injured while cleaning rail tank cars, Nebraska Railcar Cleaning Services, NRCS, and its top executives were hit with a 22-count criminal indictment. The charges include criminal conspiracy, violating safety standards resulting in worker deaths, violating the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act by dumping hazardous waste, and for submitting false documents to a federal agency. In the immediate aftermath of the incident, the company received 30 citations from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. On April 4, 2015, a check on air quality inside a tank car indicated serious risk of explosion. In spite of that warning, NRCS sent two employees into the rail car to work without further monitoring as required. Both were killed when the tank car then exploded. Following an investigation by OSHA into practices at three of the company's work sites that took place October 2015, NCRS was cited for 7 egregious, willful, 3 willful, 2 repeat, and 20 serious safety and health violations, resulting penalties reaching almost $1 million. NRCS President and owner Stephen Michael Braithwaite and Vice President and co-owner Adam Thomas Braithwaite now face charges they not only failed to implement worker safety standards, but then tried to cover that up during the subsequent OSHA inspection. They're also charged with mishandling hazardous waste removed from rail tanker cars during the cleaning process. Finally, Environmental Health Court tells EPA it can't ignore science. From thepumphandle.org for August 15th, chlorpyrifos is a neurotoxic pesticide that poses risks to brain development in fetuses and children. Nearly all residential uses of it were eliminated in 2000, but its continued use in agriculture posed unacceptable risk to farm workers and their children. EPA had proposed eliminating agricultural chlorpyrifos use in 2015, but then Scott Pruitt took over Environmental Protection Agency and abruptly reversed course. Pruitt made that decision weeks after meeting with the head of Dow Chemical, the largest chlorpyrifos manufacturer, and falsely claimed that the science on the pesticide's neurodevelopmental effects was unresolved. Earth Justice represented several environmental and labor organizations in a lawsuit against EPA over its failure to ban chlorpyrifos, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found in their favor. The 3-judge panel ordered the agency to ban all use of chlorpyrifos within 60 days. The panel held there was no justification for the EPA decision in 2017 order to maintain a tolerance for chlorpyrifos in the face of scientific evidence. Stay tuned for the EPA response. This is Mary Ariel for Safety First.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. What are the Dreamers up to? An informational meeting by the Kansas-Missouri Dream Alliance. That's right now, 7 p.m. on Thursday at SEIU Local 1, 4526 Paseo. Just run right over. Empower Missouri First Friday Forum. Stand with Immigrants. That's Friday, September 7th, 11:30 a.m. at the Kansas City, Missouri Central Library, 14 West 10th Street. Bring a sack lunch. Celebrate Labor Day late with a reading by professional union actors of Studs Terkel's Working. That's Monday, September 10th, 6:30 at the Plaza Branch Library of the Kansas City Public Library, sponsored by EARTH, Equity Actors Readers Theater. Third Saturday, Wyandotte Democratic Breakfast, Saturday, September 15th, 8:15 for breakfast, 9 o'clock for the speaker at Las Islas Maria, 7516 State Avenue, KCK. Speakers are gubernatorial candidate Laura Kelly and Sharice Davids running for Congress in the 3rd District. Me Too McDonald's March Against Sexual Harassment, Tuesday, September 18th, 11:30 to 1. That's 11:30 a.m., 6300 Paseo. I imagine they'll be marching over to the McDonald's there. And finally, Stop Hating the Criminals, Start Hating the System that Produces Criminals. Saturday, September 29th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. This is a conference at the Robert J. Mohart Multipurpose Center, 3200 Wayne in Kansas City, Missouri, sponsored by Missouri Cure. That's it. You can find our calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find archived shows and the upcoming schedule. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is going to be a review of Black KKK Klansmen. HLF is looking under the hood. Ha-ha. And the killing of DST. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
But I was too young to see. Now after standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
The conditions where you come from.